Welcome to the Data Privacy Imperative, Safeguarding Sensitive Data on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Welcome to the show. Our guests today are Richard Spires, the former CIO of the Homeland Security Department, Frank Konechny, the Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Information Dominance and the CIO in the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force, Kimberly Williams, Chief Strategist for the Public Sector at Informatica, and Andy Batten, Director of the Office of Information Collection at the EPA. It's good to have you all with us today. Our topic today is data, data security, data privacy, and all the government seems to talk about these days is data, use of data, analyzing data. And of course, recent events have made this whole idea of security and privacy so much more in the national forefront. So why don't we start before we get into the details of the discussion, let's define sensitive data, because I think the definition changes almost from year to year or generation to generation. And why don't we start with Richard Spires? What is sensitive data, and is it depending on the context you're speaking from?
Well, first, good afternoon, Tom. It's great to be here. Regarding sensitive data, I mean, there certainly are the government definitions, right, that are used for different types of data and the sensitivity of that data. But a more general point, I think, is that in today's world, and government is a great example of this, almost everything we do involves some type of personally identifiable information, right? And the protection of that, and hence the privacy issues that go with that, I think are paramount as we look at systems and we look at protecting data itself.
And would you also say that because of the way we communicate with mobility nowadays, part of that personal information also includes location, something that may not have existed as part of the data sets a generation ago?
Absolutely. And it's interesting how we're tracked by about everything we do online today, and mobility is a big factor in that today. Yes.
Okay, and Frank, in the Air Force, there's tactical data, there's logistics data, there's all of the data on airmen and so forth. How do you get your handle around what it is you need to protect?
Well, that's one of the problems that we have. There's so much, if you call it critical unclassified data out there, information, that it's difficult to actually pinpoint what is and what isn't. And what we've done is established civil security models against what type of data. And when we get into processing capabilities, there's a set of security that you have to have for each type of data. And the question always for the government, for the Air Force, is what is really PII? Is it your name by itself, or is it your name plus something else? And that has been a critical issue as to when you produce things, what is actually a privacy issue.
So name, rank, serial number is something from an old-fashioned era, I guess, the way you'd look at it now.
Would be considered almost a privacy issue.
Yeah, and what about the health
Well, the health records are very bad. HIPAA records, even when you talk about having records of the airman when he goes between different bases, all that is very difficult to process. Everything has to be cryptographically, done, encrypted, has to be all processed correctly. And so a lot of times you find some violations that we would have if you sent, for instance, the question is, do you send your own record or not, or do you send it encrypted, and you just have to send it encrypted. So we look for violations in terms of actually seeing records out there in the field that aren't encrypted.
Okay. And Andy, the EPA has another dimension that's personal in the sense that it's proprietary to corporations and business entities that EPA collects. Give us an idea of how the data comes in and what sort of data could be considered private or sensitive from the people that you collect it from.
Certainly, the individuals that are going to be reporting the information directly to the agency, we have a co-regulator program with our states and tribes where it's not only EPA that's collecting this information from corporations, but some of this is the delegated responsibility to our co-regulators. So we have the additional challenge of working with states and tribes and territories in ensuring that information about those corporations and maybe the individuals that are sending that information in are also protected.
And so often people can obtain data from the EPA that might be aggregated, but they can't get it from a particular point source that might be part of what ends up being aggregated.
That's true. So, and that's part of what we are really, I think, in the modern era, as we start seeing information being combined you know, the ability to protect privacy information is it really gets its roots in retrieving information maybe about an individual on their name or their address or their rank and serial number. But as you combine that information, you potentially put yourself or try to protect that information. It can be combined and used inadvertently incorrectly.
And Kimberly Williams, as the chief strategist in the public sector of Informatica, you have a view across all of government. What do you see? What are people worried about with respect to data and privacy, and how are the definitions evolving as you see it?
When you look at data privacy, government as a whole has many challenges. And first of all, it is illegal for that data to be leaked or breached. It is a breach of confidence to the public. They expect their data to be protected. They expect it to be confidential if they share it. And it actually has repercussions for many of the organizations across national security or across financial implications across the markets or financial implications across for individuals themselves. So it's imperative that the government really protect that data so that they don't breach any of those things. When you look at what's happening, though, it is, you know, government organizations are struggling. They know they need to protect the data, but oftentimes they don't know where that data resides. And even if they do a complete inventory, most studies find that 20 to 30% of that data still remains hidden, or it's been copied, or it resides in non-production copies as well, and they don't have the security or the procedures in place in order to protect it. And a lot of that comes down to a governance model. They need to understand how to govern their data so that they can protect it, and that's a hard thing to do across an enterprise.
And Richard, when you were in Homeland Security, I imagine data governance must have come up a lot because of how many components make up DHS. How did you approach that whole idea of who's in charge and where is it?
Well, first, let me pick up on what Kimberly was saying. The complexity of what we're dealing with here is so tremendous. And in fact, I think it's one of the big issues that we face in IT security in more generally, and of course, in data protection, data privacy. It's just the complexity factors. You can't even know what all the end devices are on your network. It's very hard to find that out. So how can you protect all this? And to her point, even understanding where all of this data resides is a big issue. She makes a great point, though, and within DHS, we had a very strong data governance model that we had formed. There was an organization focused specifically around data standards, data governance, and we're really trying to work hard to get our arms around that because you can bring all the technology that you want to bear, but if you don't have the governance model working right, if you don't have the management structures working correctly, you're not going to get the best out of those tools that you bring to bear.
So good governance covers what? Who can access data? Who can commit data to databases?
Yeah,
I
mean, what is the authoritative source for that data? Okay. Who can do what to that data, right? Who can access that data under what context? I mean, these are big issues, and obviously in the homeland security world and in the national defense world, very critically important when you're talking about protecting both the data, but also protecting individual privacy and civil liberties.
And Frank, the Air Force, of course, is a pretty diverse organization in terms of missions and functions and the platforms. And you've got the Cyber Command in there, you know, the Air Force cyber function. So what is the governance approach? What is the architecture approach so that you know where your data is to govern?
The Air Force is taking a more information management approach to it now across the board. We're putting into effect very quickly data tagging for access as well as for discovery. We're setting up an attribute-based access solution to support that because we realize that we have data everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we want to be able to tag it and control the access at its source, really, because we have data stewards. And the big thing is authoritative data sources, as Rich mentioned this. We have to get down to the point of having just several selected authoritative data sources that we actually use in all the systems because most systems now, you know, is probably built upon old technology, which means that they've used data sources that were around that may not be the authoritative data sources. And that leads to several issues with, you know, reliability as well as relevance to the data.
So you're talking about operational information?
Operational information as well as personal information, because as we progress down the path, you'll see even for names, if the old systems, remember, you had to enter your name in every system, probably those old HR systems, depending on what you are. Payroll had a different name, you know, and whatever. And that just causes confusion, mass confusion later. That's a simple case. Now, look at it from the operational viewpoint. If I put in lat long coordinates of some enemy, it better be the single authoritative source, because otherwise you're going to screw up the battle management of whatever you're trying to do.
All right. So, and then I imagine there's another complicated layer in terms of governance and data location and data format when you roll up to the Defense Department, of which you're just a part.
Yeah, we're trying to get standard. We're trying to put in NIM standards right now across the board. That's what we're. Everybody's trying to do that for DoD. We have to. We have plan in effect to get there within a couple of years at least. They're trying to do the exchange of information correctly, but then you have to look at why you're exchanging information. What is the relevance of the information? What is the purpose of the exchange? And that's probably where DoD is going to be more effective as to determining. We just don't want to release information. It has to be some reason why. Mm-hmm. And we start talking with our foreign partners. We have to make sure that the information is correct for them and that it's probably selected for particular partners that we have.
All right. And Andy, turning to EPA, you've got this multi-tier system in the country because then you have companies collecting and it goes to state agencies and then up to the EPA. How do you approach governance of data and classifying data according to sensitivity when you have that multiple stakeholder, multiple tier levels?
We have our central office, obviously, our CIO, and under the CIO, we have our senior agency official for information security, as do all federal agencies. And they have that central responsibility. Obviously, the implementation of that program becomes everybody's responsibility, and that right down to the very user. And that's one of the biggest challenges, not necessarily the biggest vulnerability, but a vulnerability is the end user, our users of this information. They also have to be aware of their responsibilities when they're using information, aware of social media attacks and those types of things that are traditionally things that they didn't have to worry about in the past. So there's really a kind of a not only the central CIO's office and their security official, but as you work down to the workforce and then out to our extended co-regulator community, it becomes everybody's responsibility.
Okay, I want to get back to that social media because that has introduced a whole data element in the federal government, and it's official stuff, not just, you know, playing around. But before we do that, I want to talk about cloud computing because that's also an initiative that is affecting every federal agency. And Kimberly, why don't we start with you? As agencies move databases and applications and so forth to clouds, especially external clouds, how does that complicate the picture of securing data and understanding what you have and where it is?
At the end of the day, it doesn't matter where the data resides. It has to be protected and it needs to be secured. So whether it's on-premise, it's off-premise, it's on the cloud, it's local, it has to be protected. And interestingly enough, that same level of protection applies to both production and non-production copies as well. So you may have data residing in your production system, and that may be in the cloud that has to be protected, but you also have to be able to protect that in a non-production environment. And oftentimes, I think the resources focus on protecting it in production. But
so that would be like the analytical or data warehouse sets that would not be in production but are still real data.
Test copies as well. So you might have a development environment, a QA environment. You may have other non-production environments for reporting. Any of those would be non-production transaction systems, but they are just as capable of being breached. So again, it's not whether it's a cloud environment or whether it's a non-cloud environment. It's any environment has to be protected. Cloud just complicates it because it's yet another copy of that data.
Can I pick up on that?
Please.
You know, it used to be in IT security and even privacy, it was all about trying to protect the systems, right, and put perimeters around and try to find intrusions and the like. And I think we all know that we're going to get, I mean, you're going to get hacked, right? It's just going to happen because, I mean, it's very sophisticated today as far as what's going on, and you can't stop it all. So the point about moving to technologies that actually protect the data, okay, wherever it resides and whether it's at rest or in motion, is a very profound and important paradigm shift in the whole area of security and likewise then just privacy. So I think that there are certainly a lot of vendors out there and a lot of movement to how do we do that at scale and in very complex organizations, you know, such as government agencies. And I'm very pleased to see that that technology has really come a long way over the last few years to help IT organizations do just that.
Okay, we're going to get to some of those technologies, too, in the next segment. Frank, in the Air Force, cloud, big issue, especially with test and development environments and the involvement of the Defense Information Systems Agency in the whole cloud picture. How does that complicate your view of the whole data question?
It's like Kimberly said, as long as it's secured in the way we want it to be, it doesn't really matter where it is. And that's what you're going to see for the DISA cloud broker, for instance. There's a security model being developed that says if you've adhered to all these security controls, which are NIST controls, then you are authorized to process this type of data. And that's what we're going to proceed down to because we want to be able to use commercial clouds as well as anybody else does. However, security is paramount all the time. And we've looked at not only processing clouds, we looked at large data object clouds because we have a lot of large data objects laying around. And the processing capabilities, the analytical capabilities involved with them as well. So we're open for anything as long as the data is secured.
All right. And Andy, what about the cloud and its effect on data for EPA? Is it a factor yet for EPA?
It is. I think most recently with our move to a new email system, Office 365, that is housed in the cloud. This has presented challenges for us in making sure that information is secure. I think what we're going to find, it's not just the cloud itself, but the data itself. You know, traditionally, we talk about protecting that data, marking that data so that we understand what it should be used for, and combining that with access controls so that individuals that have access to that data, we know that that correlation is there, that it's marked appropriately. The individual has appropriate access to that. And that's a very important shift that I think we're going to need to make is better markings of that information that will enable technology to determine if access can be given or not.
And very quickly, the EPA goes back to the late 60s. It's one of the newer federal agencies, but one of the older of the new ones, let's put it that way. And what about all that legacy information? Is that maybe moving to places where you don't need to worry about it day to day in your own environment?
I think we certainly have older data, as do others. You know, we will be, I think, along with other agencies, trying to transform a lot of our records to an electronic format and making it more accessible as needed and using technology to make it more accessible. But certainly, like many other federal agencies, a lot of our information is probably not electronically available today.
Our guests today are Andy Batten, Director of the Office of Information Collection at the EPA, Kimberly Williams, Chief Strategist for the Public Sector at Informatica, Richard Spires, the former CIO of the Homeland Security Department, and Frank Konechny, the Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Information Dominance and CIO, in the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force. I'm Tom Temin. You're listening to the Data Privacy Imperative, Safeguarding Sensitive Data, here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Last week, the FBI warned federal agencies that hackers linked to the collective known as Anonymous have secretly accessed U.S. government computers and stolen sensitive information in the Departments of Energy, Army, Health and Human Services, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and possibly other agencies. Recent data breaches have broad-reaching and costly impacts that erode public trust. I'm Bill Sullivan, Vice President with Informatica Public Sector. Information security and data privacy is a challenge for agencies due to the massive amounts of data and a lack of a comprehensive data privacy and security strategy. Informatica has been working with our government customers over 20 years to help them realize the potential of their data in a cost-effective and secure environment. Your data is not secure unless you are using Informatica data privacy solutions. Let us show you the difference Informatica can make for your agency. For more information, please visit Informatica.com. That's Informatica.com.
Welcome back to the Data Privacy Imperative, Safeguarding Sensitive Data, here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Our guests today are Frank Konechny, the Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Information Dominance and CIO in the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force, Kimberly Williams, Chief Strategist for the Public Sector at Informatica, Richard Spires, former CIO of the Homeland Security Department, and Andy Batten, the director of the Office of Information Collection at the EPA. And I'm Tom Temin, your host. And we were speaking in the first segment about the proliferation of data and the location of data and the governance of data. Let's talk about actually protecting it now and making sure it's secure and free of privacy violations. And what I've noticed in the last few years is a change or shift in approach from the firewall system surrounding approach to cybersecurity to one that seems to focus more on the data itself, regardless of platform, partly because of cloud, partly because of virtualization and the movement of data in that way. So is that a fair way to look at it, and how has that affected best practices toward handling cybersecurity? Frank, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, we've changed the focus to more data-centric as opposed to network-centric. In fact, we're trying to do a holistic viewpoint of this. The concern with the data, of course, is exfiltration of the data, but also, in a tactical sense, is the changing of the data without us noticing it. That would cause various problems in the battlefield. So that's the concern. We've gone more towards a holistic viewpoint in terms of data access, data control. As I mentioned, we're trying to get to an attribute-based access control system, which would be dynamic in the sense that it would be based on the current attributes of the person, the airman, that's trying to get access to that data. It would change dynamically. But on top of that, we're also doing application tagging in the network side. So we're whitelisting, if you will, various transaction flows in the network. So we are controlling where the application is going, as well as what transactions are being sent to the application. So we're trying to do it both ways, and holistically the network as well as the data side.
So it's a data at rest and also data in transit approach,
data
you might
rest,
say.
Yes, and data at rest is always encrypted, as well as most of the encryption will occur at data in transit as well.
So if it's all encrypted, then the implication is even if there was a breach of the network perimeter, there wouldn't be anything for anyone to do anything with because it would all be encrypted?
That's right.
Is that the theory?
Yes. There's also, when we actually track the application and tagging, we can do some deep-packet inspection of only the where it's going. And so we can restrict out where it's going. Or if we get an unknown transaction coming in from an unknown source, that can be restricted out too. So we're trying to be more holistic as opposed to just saying it's all network-based because we have too many violations of the network coming in. I mean, there's billions of things that come in, and most of them are rejected.
And, Richard, like the Air Force, Homeland Security has lots of people doing lots of missions. Most of them are not in a building somewhere. And so what was the approach there, and how is that evolving?
Well, picking up on Frank's point, I mean, different terms, but essentially the same thing, this notion of tagging the data or having metadata on the data itself, right? And it's a very critical aspect of this today to be able to control and do things with the data that you want done appropriately. And what I mean by that is this whole notion of a strong identity management capability. And this is, I think, part of the big issue we face right now is it's one thing to do identity management solutions within your own organization, but take a look at Homeland Security. If you're working with state and local governments and law enforcement and first responders, how do you appropriately identify them, right? And then how do you know what their roles really are and keep all of that current so that when they're accessing or trying to access particular data in a particular situation, okay, you can appropriately grant that access. I mean, that's where the state of the art of these tools is going, to be able to handle those kinds of solutions at scales for hundreds of thousands of users or even millions of users.
So, Kimberly, it sounds like a process of making the data be able to talk about itself, for lack of a better word, and also having the tools available to understand what the data is telling it in terms of how it's being used, who's using it, and where it's going.
Absolutely. At Informatica, we look at our best practice approach as being a discover, secure, monitor, remediate approach. We look at each of those functions as being critical to securing and making sure the data is private. Within the discover, as I mentioned before, we have to know where that data is, all the occurrences, so not just where it sits in production, but where it sits across the enterprise. We also need to be able to limit how much you see of that data at once. So that's kind of how you secure it. You need to make sure that if you're going to expose data because someone is authorized to use it, so first you say, what is the policy for which you have access to it? And then you have to look at governance around that and say, well, how many pieces of data should they be able to view at once? Because I think it's pretty common knowledge that if you have access to three pieces of personal information, then you can probably steal that person's identity. So you have to be able to secure it. We look at monitoring. If someone has access to that data, whether it be an authorized user or an unauthorized user, perhaps it's a DBA even making a copy of a data set, we need to be able to audit that, and then we need to be able to alert the necessary and appropriate people. And then finally, we look at the remediation. So as we go through and look at all of this data and we say, how many times has it been accessed? Have there been any problems? What new policies can we implement across the enterprise? So not a one-off approach, but an enterprise approach to data security to ensure that this doesn't happen and that we're constantly in that improvement cycle. And those are the best practices that you really have to employ.
And Andy, at the EPA, of course, the idea of someone changing data unbeknownst to, you know, the owners of the data, as Frank mentioned, could be a really big issue. No, I didn't do 10 parts per million. I really did 5 parts per million, whatever the case might be. And so what is your up-to-date approach for looking at data and data privacy now, given the age we're in and the fact that data is so portable?
I look at that as a two-part question. The first being the changing of the data. You know, obviously, there's got to be a data stewards network. You understand who has the ability to change information and who are you going to empower with that. So whether it's a location of a facility that needs to change, there would be a process by which we identify the individual who is submitting that change of information and making sure that the change is appropriate. And that's something we want to work on with our co-regulators, because in a state or tribe, they're going to be closest to the actual facility. Other things that we're, I think, going to face in the future with respect to the information as we move from just the perimeter, the firewalling of data, the issue of tagging that was mentioned by the other panelists, marking that data, that we all have spoken various languages of marking, whether it's confidential business information or top secret or for your eyes only. In the future, having a consistent vocabulary so that we could mark things in a common language across the federal government and with our partners, and then being able to apply access controls on a known vocabulary or known set of markings is going to become important. But initially, we just have to get to a point where we are speaking that same language when it comes to tagging and marking.
So it sounds like the Office of Information Collection, which is a distinct entity at EPA, you don't see that at every agency. What are you primarily concerned with in the office? Is it the security of the collection and the integrity of it?
Primarily the integrity to start with. Certainly our first responsibility is information exchange with our co-regulators. We are also responsible for records management, privacy, Freedom of Information Act, so we are providing information to requesters of that information. And then to the public, making information that is making it freely accessible when it's appropriate and not creating unnecessary barriers. So we do have a full life cycle of receiving that information, making sure that it's available for or handled properly for special programs, whether, again, it's privacy or records, but also not creating unnecessary barriers for the public who should be able to access this information freely.
Okay, the federal government has no shortage of standards and laws that govern a lot of things related to data and security. We have HIPAA, which covers, of course, health information. NIST, as an organization, has published thousands of pages of guidance and not so much regulations, but standards and definitions for every tiny aspect of the whole data question. And we have the FISMA law, which is much maligned, but it has caused agencies over the years to at least make sure they have some regular examination of their security. But everyone says they don't do enough. So how far do those laws and sets of definitions and guidelines really go? And where do they leave off that agencies have to pick up and do for themselves? Richard?
Well, I would first say that, I mean, they do a lot. And I mean, I know they tend to get maligned. But the fact of the matter is, like, for instance, in this guidance, I think there's some excellent guidance. But if you look at this stuff, it's all like FISMA. It's all risk-based, right? So it's really still up to the agency to decide, okay, system by system or data set by data set, okay, how that data should be protected using their guidelines as, you know, if you will, a way to go about it, but it's still, where do you draw those lines? Okay, how far do you want to go to protect certain data sets based on a risk-based decision? And that's the way I think it should be. No issue with that. But I go back to the complexity factor we talked about earlier, which is just that there is so much data and it's so dispersed that I think that's where the real issues lie today. It's getting your arms around the data. That's the bigger problem, if you will, than the standards issues that we face at this point.
So the standards don't really give you operational guidance. That depends on your situation and what you have to do.
Yes, that's correct.
And Frank, what about at the Air Force? I mean, there's DOD standards and definitions that are separate from all the ones that the civilian agencies have.
Right. There's DOD policy about PII and about HIPAA. PII is actually more restrictive than HIPAA in some senses. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to, for FISMA, it's really we're going to risk management framework using the standards. And we're trying to get a standard across all of DOD because of reciprocity issues. Because usually when the DAA comes for each system and each service, they have a slightly different viewpoint of what is correct security for that particular application or that data set. And so we're trying to across the board, figure out what should be that risk management framework for pieces of same pieces of data across the board.
So it sounds like you almost need an engine of security to make these decisions in real time.
At times, yes. And that's why reciprocity is so important now. As DOD becomes more of an enterprise as opposed to an individual service organization, they're going to go to the point where saying, well, if I build a system and I put it into the enterprise, everybody is going to be vulnerable at some point in time because it's all connected. So therefore, reciprocity and standardization of what we mean by risk management framework is becoming more and more important.
So standardizing on the standards and then deriving operations out of that.
Yes, sir.
All right. And Kimberly, for people that are helping the government as contractors and suppliers of technology, those guidelines and definitions, the NIST and the FISMA and the HIPAA, are they just something that you check off to say, yeah, we got that? Or do they really guide product strategies, and how do you bake it all in together?
Well, certainly I think they do guide our product strategy, because we really look beyond just those standards and say, what is really the problem and how do we address it? If you look at HIPAA or FISMA, there's requirements, and we meet those within the products. But we also look beyond that and say, there's retention policies. There's FOIA requests that also have to be considered in that. There's certainly agency-specific policies. If you look at a technology like encryption, certainly valid, it protects data, but it doesn't allow you to have a policy-driven approach to protecting that data. So if you can retain something for 5 years, after that, you need to have a policy that says right there on the data that that cannot be released. Or if you have a FOIA request and you want to make sure that that data never is part of that FOIA request, if you can include that in the policy and have a technology that supports that policy, which is very important. That's where we're going. We're not saying it's enough to secure it. We're saying we have to meet the basic regulations, but then provide agencies the ability to have even more capabilities beyond that.
So the metadata that might be associated with a particular set might also include information about what you have to do with it and what its life cycle handling requirements are.
You can do it at the metadata level, or we believe that you can put that in the technology solution as well, and you can actually secure the data using the technology. The metadata is important to understand which pieces are sensitive so that you can enact that policy.
But my question was, can that capability be part of the data itself along with the metadata?
Yes, absolutely.
Not part of the application necessarily, but part of the data itself. So if that data moves to some other environment completely with another application, if there's interoperability, then that data would be similarly protected when it goes.
Absolutely. And in fact, we would believe that you shouldn't do it at the application level. This should always be about the data. So it doesn't matter if you've copied it from production to test. It doesn't matter if you've moved it to the cloud. It doesn't matter if you're doing it from a report rather than the application. Mm-hmm. How many times do you run a query rather than go through your application? It always needs to be secured.
Okay. And Andy, so that's a lot to chew on for the EPA. And what's your approach?
Well, respect to the FISMA and other guidances that are out there, the one that I'd like to point out is the Privacy Act of 1974. And a lot of what we do in the privacy world when we initially look at systems is we conduct a privacy impact assessment. And we're looking at a single system to see if the information that's retrieved is retrieved based on a piece of privacy information, such as a name or an address or a phone number, let alone sensitive privacy information like your bank account number or something like that. The problem is, in this day and age, and why we need to take another look at the Privacy Act of 74, is when you're looking at information sharing and the ability to combine information, you're not necessarily looking at that individual system and how it retrieved information off a personal identifying piece of information, but you're looking at the combination effect and how people may be putting different sources of information together. And I think that may be one of the things we need to look at as we go forward. What do we need to do to advance what the intent is of the 74 Privacy Act?
So you almost need to put data all through a filter. It's not a great word, but some way of optimizing or equalizing what the data says about itself and the way it reacts to applications, no matter what the source, so that it comes out being able to be interoperable in terms of privacy and protection at the other end.
Well, we were looking at technologies and solutions where you'd actually have automated business rules to be able to assess the metadata, the data itself, within the context of the situation as to whether you're going to grant access. And that would take into account things like privacy issues, civil liberties issues. And I think that's where you need to go in order to address these very actually complex issues when you start combining data.
Yeah.
All right, our guest today, Frank Konechny, the Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Information Dominance and CIO in the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force, Andy Batten, the Director of the Office of Information Collection at EPA, Richard Spires, the former CIO of the Homeland Security Department, and Kimberly Williams, Chief Strategist for the Public Sector at Informatica. I'm Tom Temin. You're listening to the Data Privacy Imperative, Safeguarding Sensitive Data, here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Last week, the FBI warned federal agencies that hackers linked to the collective known as Anonymous have secretly accessed U.S. government computers and stolen sensitive information in the Departments of Energy, Army, Health and Human Services, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and possibly other agencies. Recent data breaches have broad-reaching and costly impacts that erode public trust. I'm Bill Sullivan, Vice President with Informatica Public Sector. Information security and data privacy is a challenge for agencies due to the massive amounts of data and a lack of a comprehensive data privacy and security strategy. Informatica has been working with our government customers over 20 years to help them realize the potential of their data in a cost-effective and secure environment. Your data is not secure unless you are using Informatica data privacy solutions. Let us show you the difference Informatica can make for your agency. For more information, please visit Informatica.com. That's Informatica.com.
Welcome back to the Data Privacy Imperative, Safeguarding Sensitive Data, here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Our guests today are Andy Batten, the Director of the Office of Information Collection at the EPA, Richard Spires, former Department of Homeland Security CIO, Kimberly Williams, Chief Strategist for the Public Sector at Informatica, and Frank Konechny, the Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Information Dominance and CIO in the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force. I'm Tom Temin. And one of the biggest issues regarding threat protection and privacy and taking care of data, of course, is the insider threat, which is not something that was happening just this year or last year, but goes way back since there was data. We've had problems with insider losses. So let's talk about first the best practices for control of access and also for control of unintentional losses, which well-meaning people can do at any level in an organization. We'll talk about the more nefarious later on. But what are some best practices for maintaining safe access by the people that have to have it and also preventing the unintentional loss? Andy, why don't we start with you?
Certainly, starting with the unintentional loss part of that, I think the one of the most important aspects of this is education and training of staff, not only so that they are aware of how they should behave, but aware of the threats. I think it's been to our benefit that we see more phone calls inside asking for clarification on security policies. It's a good sign, not necessarily a bad sign, that there's more traffic and more phone calls. They're asking for clarification. They're asking about their own security of their own information. And I think through education and awareness, we've been able to significantly raise the awareness of their responsibility. And I think it really starts there.
But you do have to have specific control mechanisms for who can look at which particular sets of data too, right?
Absolutely. And I think that really goes to access controls, having a strong identity management system within the agency, and when you're sharing information with your partners. But it starts again within the agency, making sure that there's a strong correlation between who the individual is, what particular function they're performing. Some of our individuals have to have access to privacy information if they're in, say, the HR human resources community. And that's a special level of education and special level of access controls that need to be applied to that, that sector of the workforce.
And Frank, sometimes the armed services are characterized as being hard and tough on the outside, but kind of soft and easy to penetrate on the inside, because you have people working in teams so closely. So what are best practices for the Air Force these days in terms of controlling access but making it available to those that have to have it?
Well, as I mentioned, we're trying to get down to ABAC controls based on who you are and what you're doing. There's also limitations now, as for the system administrators, as to limited sets is what they can do. Before, we had system administrators that had very large power bases of what they can actually get through, and that's been limited. There's also reporting, logging of what they're doing, and not so much over-logging, because a lot of it's used forensically afterwards, and that doesn't help you afterwards. You want to know what's happening now. And so there's some heuristics that are being implemented that will basically forecast if something has actually happened. But it's really hard in the armed services because of the way that we're giving taskings. So one day you may have a congressional inquiry in, and you'll be pulling data from sources that you never knew you had never knew you had access to before. And so there has to be more dynamics into the services as to how they get access.
All right. And Richard, this access idea, what are the best practices on the civilian agency side when you have this huge federation of components like DHS did?
Well, I both Andy and Frank, I think, mentioned this issue of access control and attribute-based access control. And I think that is the key. And that's a data-centric model again, right? We're talking about providing access based on that really need to know or need to use that particular data in that particular context. It's not easy to get to that at scale, but it is absolutely where we need to get as a government.
Now, Kimberly, of course, vendors come into this because we now know that they house a lot of government data for whatever purposes, fulfilling contracts and being cloud providers and a host of other reasons. So, and often it's test data or developmental data or developmental programs that are not quite deployed, variety of things. How do you control that from the vendor level to make sure you're closed with respect to the customer?
Well, recent events, certainly the last 6 months, have raised the awareness of SIs and vendors as a whole, contractors, that they have a responsibility and they have a liability if they don't control the access to the data that they see. They need to, and there's two parts of that. There's education. If they see something they shouldn't be seeing, they need to have a reporting chain. But there's also the notion that it is, as any test environment or any development project kicks off, that these contractors need to have a strong test data management policy in place. So, for example, they need to look at what data really needs to be brought down from production. Who should be seeing it, even within their own contractors, as well as who they're working with, and they need to be able to figure out what works and what doesn't work. So we use kind of the term test data management to describe that, and it's really about, again, who should have access to it. Should that data be masked before it's ever presented to a contractor? So, for example, when you bring a data back from production, does it need to be a full copy of the production database, or can you subset that data so that you're not seeing perhaps the most sensitive data? You're seeing some portion of that data, but you're not seeing all of the data. Then you have to say, can I change the data without being able to change the meaning of the test? So can you persistently change or persistently mask that data so that they still see someone's name, but they don't see someone's real name? They still see their Social Security number, but they don't really see the real Social Security number. Again, if you can't identify who that person is, it's very hard to have a breach around that. So that's one aspect of it. But the other aspect of it is, beyond testing, there's certainly the development environment, there's QA environments, there's migration environments. You have to apply the same security to those level environments that you did to production. And that's something we talked about in the first segment. It's not really where the data is housed. It's the fact that you need to secure it across your environment.
Okay, so that deals with some of the possible inadvertent leaks or, you know, mistakes by people that you trust. But what about people you trust that are deliberately trying to harm the organization? We've seen some pretty bad examples of that in recent years. Andy, what do you do beyond the access controls and education you have for the good folks to prevent the occasional bad apple?
And there are other forms of technology that I think we can leverage that will help us here, whether it's computer access cards that are from a technology endpoint are utilized to help us control information at the desktop. This is just another form of technology, or continuous monitoring of our networks, looking for spikes, looking for unusual activity, another form of technology, and then data loss prevention tools. So making sure that if information does exfiltrate, we have a good idea and we stop it before it happens. So for instance, software that may be looking for the exfiltration of a pattern on social security numbers or something like that. Those are the kinds of controls that we will be looking at, and we probably need to be incorporating more of.
And so that would be something you'd need an alert in real time to somebody before the, you know.
Absolutely. I think, you know, having certainly in the data loss prevention tools, you know, stopping it before it leaves, but also when there is an incident, reconstructing what happened and understanding what information may have been lost is important to the learning process and better utilization of those tools over time.
So you have to have tools then, Frank, that both tell you what's going on when it's happening and also that lets you have those lessons learned to find out after the fact, when you do the debrief, what happened.
Right. And that's sometimes hard because the bad guys aren't quite obvious in what they're doing. And so there's various exfiltration methods that are being utilized that take data at odd times so you don't never see a spike. As Andy said, you never see anything. You just see data flowing out. Now, we're trying to do something else, too. We're trying to go towards a digital rights management policy for documents so that if you leave the DoD domain, it's encrypted already, and you won't be able to get access to it unless you're in the domain. So we're working on those now so that any documents that leave will not be available whatsoever.
So the CIO doesn't want to get that 2 a.m. call that, hey, we have something really bad happening here.
That's right.
Right, Richard?
But, of this, though, does come down to, particularly when you're looking at insider threat for those that have elevated access privileges, right, your system admins, those kinds of individuals. I mean, a lot of this is you got to put in place very good management practices. And so often you find, for expediency or other reasons, those practices just are not really followed to our detriment, frankly, from time to time. And now there are tool sets that can help you with that, and certainly tools that are monitoring. The more we move to continuous monitoring will help. But you need to have a situation where no one individual, right, can do significant damage without it being immediately detected. That's what you're really trying to make sure.
Because from a technical standpoint, you could have so much monitoring of activity that you would produce huge data sets that themselves would be an impediment to finding out what's going on.
That is correct. And so if you're generating, it turns into a big data problem itself, right? Where you've got all of these access audit logs, and you're actually trying to find information on those in a very almost real-time basis. And so I'm not saying it's an insignificant problem, but it does start with good management practice. That goes a long way to helping address this problem.
And Kimberly, what are some of the latest tools that can enable this so that the information, the nugget you need to protect your cyber in the moment is available without getting lost in all of this log data?
When we talked about best practices in the previous segment, we talked about discover, secure, monitor, and remediate. And across the board, we as an industry have to provide solutions that enable organizations to do each of those things better. In this particular case, we're really talking about the secure and monitor and remediate portion of it because you have to secure it. We believe that you have to secure it in production and non-production. Sometimes you have to persistently mask it. Encryption really isn't enough because it's not policy-driven. It doesn't allow on-the-fly masking necessarily. It doesn't allow you to implement a policy where you're saying, I want to limit the number of pieces of data that you can see at once. If you give unfettered access to someone so they can see all of the private pieces of information, that's a much bigger problem than if you limit how many times they have to go back or how many different places they have to go to get that information. So when we look at the tools, we really have to look at ways that we can have a policy-driven access. We can have policy-driven masking. We can mask in production. We can mask in the test and non-production environments. And that we can provide people the way to look at what happened and why so that they can remediate change. And I think to Richard's point, you have to have that governance on the back end and the front end saying, here's the policy, here's the management policy, here's the data policy, here's the operations policy, and marry those all into one solution. And I think today what you see is technology that can be policy driven.
So it sounds like there's a balancing act that has to happen between having the safety and controls and mechanisms in place you need, but also letting people do their work in some reasonable fashion.
Absolutely.
All right, well, that brings our discussion to a close. I'd like to thank our guests, Richard Spires, former CIO of the Homeland Security Department, Frank Konechny, the Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Information Dominance and CIO in the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force, Kimberly Williams, Chief Strategist for the Public Sector at Informatica, and Andy Batten, Director of the Office of Information Collection at the EPA. And we thank you for listening to The Data Privacy Imperative, Safeguarding Sensitive Data. I'm Tom Temin, Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Thank you for listening to The Data Privacy Imperative, Safeguarding Sensitive Data on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Last week, the FBI warned federal agencies that hackers linked to the collective known as Anonymous have secretly accessed U.S. government computers and stolen sensitive information in the Departments of Energy, Army, Health and Human Services, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and possibly other agencies. Recent data breaches have broad-reaching and costly impacts that erode public trust. I'm Bill Sullivan, Vice President with Informatica Public Sector. Information security and data privacy is a challenge for agencies due to the massive amounts of data and a lack of a comprehensive data privacy and security strategy. Informatica has been working with our government customers over 20 years to help them realize the potential of their data in a cost-effective and secure environment. Your data is not secure unless you are using Informatica data privacy solutions. Let us show you the difference Informatica can make for your agency. For more information, please visit Informatica.com. That's Informatica.com.